Just hit it on here?
Yeah, anytime we're going.
Hello, my name's Charlie Crockett, and you listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiplett. And you are listening to the best gosh darn podcast in the whole world, Walking the Floor. I'm back home from tour this week, enjoying that. I'm enjoying my kids. I'm enjoying my coffee maker, but it's brief. I got to leave again on Sunday for a couple weeks because I got to head back out to Nashville to finish my new record that I've been working on with Mr. Dave Cobb out there and company. And when I get done recording this podcast, I gotta like go through the giant stack of mail that's sitting on my desk. It's been staring at me all week, but I gotta get to it. I gotta get organized. You know, I've don't think that I've actually ever been caught up since I had kids, and I doubt I'll ever actually be caught up. And I just mean life stuff, caught up with life stuff. I got a constant cycle of things that I'm not taking care of. And I don't think I'm gonna get back in the game until like probably my youngest kid goes to college. When I'm sitting here alone, empty nesting, that's when your old pal, Mr. Shifter, is gonna get caught up with life. But until then, I'm gonna be a hot mess. I had a good little time in Nashville last week. We were just there for like a day. But I interviewed Mr. Tyler Mahan Coe from the one of the greatest podcasts out there these days called Cocaine and Rhinestones. If you haven't listened to it, listen to it. It's great. It's going to be my next episode in 2 weeks, so definitely check that out. Oh, and I wanted to mention a new friend of the show, Garrett T. Capps, sent me a copy of his new record on vinyl. It's called In the Shadows Again. If you haven't listened to it, listen to it. It's fantastic. He's a cat from down in Texas. It's got like a sort of Texas vibe to it. I don't even know it's exactly where you would pigeonhole him. He's got like a Texas influence, and even like I hear like X and stuff in there. So I got to interview this guy and find out what his influences are, because it's a great record. In the Shadows Again. He also sent me unexpectedly a really good Jerry Jeff Walker album on vinyl too. So thank you, Garrett T. Capps. Check him out. I want to remind everybody out there too that our website has a whole new look, and every week now we're putting links to the guests and things that we talk about in the interview up on walkingthefloor.com. It's fantastic. It's better than ever. And if you like what you hear in the interview and you want to be like, what band was that guy mentioned that I should check out, there's very well a link to that information on walkingthefloor.com. While you're doing that, get on over to your Spotify account and follow the Walk in the Floor playlist, because I checked just now, we have 1,989 followers, which means we're only 11 short of breaking 2,000, which is well short of the 500,000 ultimate goal. Also, way under the 77 million views that This Is America by Childish Gambino has gotten to date. So come on, if like 2 million of the people that watched that awesome video just go over and follow my playlist, then we'll be in business. Of course, I realize that my Walking the Floor Spotify playlist does not carry the cultural impact of that Childish Gambino video, which if you haven't seen, you should really watch, because you might learn something. That's pretty much the best thing that's happened all week, in my view. Love it. What else is going on? That's pretty much everything. Let's get on over to Zounds.com and sell some gear. Zounds.com. You love them. It's your home on the internet to get all your music gear. You need a new guitar, a new amp, some new microphones, whatever. Get over there. Every order, $599 and above, is eligible for their exclusive 12 payment plan. There's no application process. There's no interest charged. And you just make your first payment and the gear ships immediately. Zounds.com. All right, let's get on over to the interview.
Call me up, darling. I'll be there in a hurry.
All right, so I recently had a day off in Dallas, Texas. which happened to line up with Charlie Crockett doing a hometown show at the Majestic Theater, which is also the day that his new record, Lonesome as a Shadow, came out. So it was kind of like a record release party. If you don't know Charlie Crockett, he is, in fact, a distant relative of Davy Crockett. He grew up poor on the Texas border down by Mexico, and he learned his craft like busking in the streets of New Orleans, the honky-tonks of Dallas, the New York City subways, Paris, Morocco. This is a guy that's been all over the world and accomplished quite a bit in a short amount of time. This is his fourth record in 4 years, which makes him one of the hardest working men in Americana. It's making all the rest of us look pretty lazy. This is Charlie Crockett on Walking the Floor.
Hold me one more time. You know that I need you. Got to make your mind.
I've listened to your program many times, man.
This thing, you've heard it before?
Yes, man. Oh, that's how I know about you, man.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah. I've listened to you talk to, obviously, everybody's heard the Merle Haggard stuff, but you did Justin Townes Earl.
Yeah.
Really amazing conversation.
Oh, yeah. He was great, man. He had the best line in that. I forget what I asked. I asked him something about his dad, and he goes, "My dad's crazy, but I'm a gangster."
I did, yeah. I heard that. That's what you quote. That's like you took like a little clip, right?
Yeah, as a little
trailer.
Yeah. I think it did. Yeah.
He's a big influence on me. He's one of the most important modern people, like in kind of doing roots music.
Yeah. I could see. He seems like somebody that you would have like toured with over the years.
I wish, man. I've seen him around throughout the years, man. He came up to Northern California up there where we was a couple times, stopping by my girl's place, and that's how I met him. And
well, were you living in Northern California?
Yeah, I was.
Oh, whereabouts?
Mendocino County.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I've been there. You've kind of been all over the place, right?
My life, yeah. I hitchhiked a whole lot when I was younger, and so I started going out on those. I used to live out on them pop farms. I lived out there. That's kind of how I got going.
Since we kind of tripped onto that, I'll just start there. I was wondering, why did you set out on the road hitchhiking? Were you already performing at that point, or was that did the two go hand in hand, or did you start hitchhiking then start performing? Like, how'd that come together?
Yeah, it happened together. You know, it's like I was getting in a lot of trouble. You know. I think
at home.
I felt at home.
San Benito?
Really in Dallas here.
Okay.
And in New Orleans. Just getting in a lot of trouble.
So you grew up in San Benito though, right? That's like where you were born.
Yeah,
you grew up, and then what, you moved to Dallas and then New Orleans?
Exactly. My mama moved us up to Dallas, and my daddy wasn't around, so she sent me to live with my uncle.
Okay.
Sorry, I got to use some work on my voice for tonight.
Oh yeah, no worries, man.
She sent me to live with my uncle. In New Orleans, and that's where I started seeing street performers, because he worked in the French Quarter.
Were you already playing at that point?
No, I wasn't playing. I was only singing. I had been singing since I was young. I mean, not in the official way, but I was confident in singing and loved to do that.
Yeah.
And then I picked up the guitar. She saw my interest. I was interested in sitting out on the street with the players out there, just kind of watching. And so I guess I was standing around them more before I started playing with them.
Like, what's that? Like, are they open to a young kid coming up that can't play guitar, that's just kind of hanging around? Like, are they like, "Hey, man, here's some chords and check it out"? Or was it like, "Get the fuck out of here"?
I mean, some of them, you knew to stay away from.
Right.
You know, some of them were obvious. Some of them were all, be gacked out. You wouldn't go near those guys. Some of them like to have you around, like to have the company. Won't talk to you about the blues and music that they know and stuff. And I hung out with people like that. I started doing that in my teens. And, I'm still that way now. I mean, in this town, I got taught more how to do this in the broke down back room blues clubs and kind of jams of Dallas in New Orleans, more than the scene here.
Right.
That's a new thing for me. But I was playing in the seafood restaurants with all the old blues dudes.
Right.
They were letting me get up, do my thing and shit.
Like when you're busking out in a place like New Orleans where there's so many musicians all over the place and people busking all over, how many songs do you have to know to sort of keep up, to be a part of it, imagine there's I remember a buddy of mine lives in Austin, said to play in the pickup scene there.
Yeah.
There's an unofficial song, but about 200 songs. You just got to know, and then you'll be able to get a gig kind of thing. Is it especially same kind of thing?
Well, especially as if you're a hired gun,
right.
A side man, you got to know everybody. You got to know all the standards, and that's true, because in New Orleans, what's really valuable is tradition, is traditional music.
Right.
So jazz, or traditional jazz, early swing. But also in the street more, which is what I learned a lot more of, was a lot of what the jug bands was playing. And they were playing more blues and country, you know, that kind of stuff. A lot more kind of traditional.
Like honky-tonk and that sort of
thing? Yeah, man, like I learned Ernest Tubb songs on the street in New Orleans. I learned Driving Nails on Royal Street. And, you know, I knew the song before I knew Ernest.
Right.
And I didn't think he could sing for shit at first. And I've got, now I'm obsessed with Ernest Tubb.
Right,
I know, like,
right.
30 of his songs.
Yeah.
You know?
That's funny. Was there a point where you heard, like, the original versions of all those songs? Like, what? Who's doing that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't hear Driving Nails. Like, the traditional New Orleans jazz tunes that we was playing influenced how I played Driving Nails more than the original. I heard that first. And then I heard Ernest E.T. later.
Right.
And I've kind of incorporated some of that. But I also wrote my own ending and stuff. I like to adapt people's songs and stuff.
Right.
I learned about Hank Williams that way. Or learned his songs that way.
Right.
I knew who these guys were, but I didn't know their music. You know, coming up as a millennial like I am, a lot of that stuff wasn't, you know, there was all this bullshit dominating your life.
Yeah.
You know, and I had to, it really was hip hop that broke me out of that through the conscious hip hop with the great sampling.
Okay.
The rhythm and blues part of hip hop and stuff and going back to the artists that were being sampled or gravitating towards the artists that were really incorporating jazz, you know, into you know, because that's what hip hop is to me, is America's modern heritage of jazz and blues in a lot of ways.
Was hip hop like kind of your entry point as a music fan?
Yeah, man. I was listening to, you know, a lot of old school music growing up through my mama. She was into all that stuff, so I was aware of all that. But I needed, you know, we struggled. We was in poverty, you know.
Right.
Like, growing up in South Texas, outside of a little town down there, you know, living in a trailer.
And that's almost on the Mexican border, right?
Yeah, man. Where we lived in Los Fresnos, outside of Los Fresnos, that's like a 15-minute ride to the border right there.
Okay.
So, you know, it was, you know, it's grown a lot, but it's always been a poor area. But I really loved it. It's an amazing culture down there, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's, you know, whites are the minority by a long shot, you know? It's 95%, 90%+ Latino. It's an amazing, amazing culture. And we lived out in the country. So it was all, you know, cotton, coastal plains, cotton fields, grapefruit, oranges. There used to be sugarcane more when I was younger. So
You know. And surf? Did you surf at all? I surf. I'm from California. So anytime I see that anybody's from somewhere close to the coast, I know that there's surf down there in like South Padre Island.
Yeah,
or something
Padre
like that,
off the jetties. Yeah. I taught myself to surf in my 20s actually, by being kind of like a road bum.
Yeah.
And then I would go down and stay in Port Aransas. I used to play all the bars down there along Corpus Christi and stuff.
Yeah, okay.
There's some good surfing off the piers out there and stuff.
We had a day off.
Easy
Austin.
Surfing compared to what you're used to, but like, you know, I ride some 4-foot bumps and
Great, man.
Yeah.
Whatever works, man.
Yeah,
we had a day off in Austin a couple days ago, and I went and surfed that. There's a wave pool there.
Okay.
Have you seen that thing?
That's crazy.
Inland wave. It's mental, dude.
I don't know nothing
it's
about
so
it.
So bizarre.
I heard about it. I think I saw it in the Chronicle.
Yeah, it doesn't break like an ocean wave. So it's like you kind of almost have to take your surfing knowledge and throw it out the window a little bit, because like a couple basic things don't apply.
That's
and
crazy.
It fucks you all up. And you're like, what? I'm surfing like a fucking asshole right now. What
you got to figure it out, man.
I was in there for 2 hours. My last wave, I rode all the way through.
That's crazy.
I was like, oh, just give me another hour.
That's wild, man.
So fun.
It's an amusement park, basically, like for surfing.
Yeah, it's exactly what it is, but it's like Disney surf. Anyway.
Disney surf,
I read that Freddie Fender was from that same part of Texas. I mean,
we were born in the same town.
Okay, so was he any kind of presence? I mean, I imagine he would have been long gone by the time you came along, but was he part of the sort of local culture?
Man, when I was a kid, I mean, I was born in the mid-80s, man, so when... I mean, Freddie Fender was a king down there, you know, and the Johnny Canales show was really big and featured mostly all South Texas music. And, you know, I mean, Freddie Fender was and is like, you know, like Selena big down there, you know, in the Tornadoes and stuff. So it wasn't like, I mean, I was hearing that as like the earliest probably music I was ever really around was a lot of Freddie Fender. I mean, he was just around, you know. And, you know, ZZ Top lived down there on the island.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my mama, I guess, used to go over I guess she'd been over there a few times. She did. She used to tell me the story that she didn't know she'd been over to ZZ Top's house until after she had left and found out that those were the guys that they like.
Who were those bearded men?
Yeah. So, you know, that kind of South Texas culture. But for me, it wasn't like I was listening to, was like consciously influenced by Freddie Fender early on. It really came just through my journey, through my pilgrimage that I've come to, and that's happened. I've like, it's like coming home to roost on a lot of things like that. It's like, I didn't really realize my connection to Freddie till I was in New Orleans playing on the street. And, you know, people would find out I was from South Texas, you know, and I'd be playing in all them street bands and getting in some of them blues clubs and stuff. And these guys was like, well, you know, Freddie, you know, Freddie played on the street here in New Orleans, you know, when he was young, when he was your age.
Really?
And I was like, what in the world? And I found out that he had he played with the Nevilles all up and down in all them clubs back
Oh, really?
Like back in the 60s. And,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he really got schooled on a lot of the New Orleans sound through the Nevilles and a lot of that New Orleans stuff. He did a couple years in Angola for like a couple joints.
Really?
Yeah.
Like post being famous or prior to that?
I think it was like right in the... He had a long career because everybody knows him from like when the next teardrop, before the next teardrop falls or like Wasted Days and Wasted Nights. And, yeah. Hey Baby, K Paso, all that type of stuff. But what, I mean, you ever heard that late 50s, early 60s stuff of him where he's doing like crazy Tejano, rockabilly,
no,
blues? Oh man, it's like he belongs in a category with like Clifton Chenier and like Magic Sam and like Howlin' Wolf and stuff, you know, for that early stuff he was doing.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, he did time there for like a little bit of weed. I mean, you're talking about a Mexican dude. You know, in
getting rung up with a couple of joints
in Louisiana,
right? What in the 50s or something? Come on. that probably didn't go over well,
man. You know, so, but anyway, yeah, and that's, I could say the same thing about like T-Bone Walker. Mm. He was somebody that used to play barefoot as a kid in the street in Deep Ellum here in Dallas.
Oh, really? And, he was a Texas guy.
Oh yeah, yeah. The Deep Ellum here. I don't know how familiar you are with the neighborhood.
I used to play there a lot, in the 90s, you know, like when I was in a band called No Use for a Name, that was like where you always played. And it's funny because
I heard you mention them on your program.
Yeah, I was just talking to somebody yesterday on our crew, like, I wonder if Deep Ellum's still happening, because I haven't been down to Deep Ellum for a long time.
Deep Ellum has been the name of my whole game. That's where I put the band together. I played all these juke joints. There's been a renaissance, and it has good and bad things going on, like, there's the line between Renaissance and gentrification,
right,
and is always an issue.
Sure,
but me and a lot of cats in this era were able to get on this wave of a new interest in Deep Ellum. So I mean, I was ringing those clubs for a couple years, playing 2-3 times a day, mostly in Deep Ellum. I mean, beer joints all over Texas and out in Fort. Like we would play like a morning gig in Deep Ellum. Might go play a beer joint in the afternoon in Fort Worth, and then come over and play the late night gig at like Adair's or the Freeman, and we would do that. We were doing that every week for a couple of years.
So like when you're talking about a beer joint, like what my image of a beer joint would be like something from the past with a bunch of guys just coming in from working in the oil field. You know what I mean? Like what's sort of the reality of what is a modern day version of that you're talking about?
Well, I mean now you know you got this whole there's this whole like new era of like what are they like. Craft breweries.
Right.
And so like the cats that I was working with that were booking us just on a handshake around North Texas.
Yeah.
13th Floor Music, this boy named Ken Welker, he had and still does have all these like breweries paying and bringing bands in there. You know what I'm saying? Because they were making that money. It's been a big thing, you know, and these companies have been getting bought up and all this type of stuff. And so it would be a mix of those type of places. But let me tell you, man, down here in Texas, you know, in the Deep South, there's still a lot of beer joints. Like Adair's is definitely the old school beer joint, like you would imagine it is.
Right.
Could walk there. There's a ton of places like that. Riley's Tavern,
right
down there in San Marcos. Grady's 66 up there in Yukon, Oklahoma, out kind of OKC. There's really a lot of beer joints.
It's funny, man. I've interviewed a lot of Texas musicians, and I always talk about on my show that I'm fascinated by this sort of the Texas circuit and the sort of insular support that artists from here get from their fellow Texans. I think it's like it's amazing that it's probably the only place in America that tradition has endured. You know, where you had that all in all the other parts of America. You know, there's a strong West Coast country music scene back in the day and all.
Right, the blues scene used to be real big, running up and down the 99.
All that shit's gone, man. Yeah. But like, it seems like in Texas somehow it is. persevered?
Well, man, you know, it's a... Texas is a nation, man, you know? And there's a lot of people that have some real ignorant pride over that. But then the real Texas is a very strong, very diverse Texas that has that is represented by many races, cultural backgrounds. But we also have an independent economy, you know? As much as Texas has a long history of a lot of, you know, Wild West dealings, you know, it does lead the country in wind energy now, even in the same fields that the cotton grows.
Oh,
now,
really?
And down where I'm from, on the coastal plains.
Right.
They have those leading
big wind turbines out in the water.
They're huge. I think they say something like 10 to 15% of Texas' energy is generated by wind farms now.
Really?
Yeah, that's an accurate number. Now, you think about that, considering it's like the belly of the, like, oil machine.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. There's some interesting stuff happening politically down here. There was just actually...
on a lot of levels, yeah.
Yeah, that guy Beto trying to unseat... Cruz.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens with that. That's interesting to watch, you know?
I try to stay out of making any judgments on all that, but I heard that he's given that it's a close thing.
He's outraised him, and it's all small dollar.
Yeah, man.
None of it's like PAC money. So it's, you know, I don't know exactly. I haven't followed it closely or anything, so I don't know exactly where sits politically, but, you know, I think that it's just cool to see somebody, you know, kind of upending the status quo a little bit.
And I mean, honestly, just to kind of touch on that, but it's like, that's the thing about Texas. Like, there's this, like, there's this Texas hubris and there's this very scary image of Texas. Then there's this other, like, really amazing, inclusive Texas. I mean, it's all together, you know.
Right.
It's all part of it. But, you know, Texas was a country.
Right.
And, you know, for better or for worse, like, all Texans of every background feel that in some way. And so I think if you want to tie it to culture, like, that's where it really can show in a positive way. You know, like, I love, you know, Dallas, like, that's what I mean, man. Like, that Dallas sound, like, Deep Ellum is really true. Dallas is really one of the most important cities in the world in the history of blues because of Deep Ellum, because it was the first black commercial district in the state of Texas before Houston, so, or anything, you know. And, I mean, let me name the people to you that played on the street in this neighborhood. We're talking about Robert Johnson, Lightnin' Hopkins.
Right.
T-Bone Walker, Blind Lemon Jefferson, Leadbelly. Henry Thomas, Bessie Smith, Mile Rainey, Mance Lipscomb. I mean, Washington Phillips. It's so deep.
And right.
There's like 25 figures. Bob Wills.
Right.
Bob Wills and those dudes are on record saying they learned a lot of the stuff that they was playing that they were world renowned for out of Deep Ellum.
Sure.
You know, it's that place where black and white, the European and black and Latino world converged. And the only reason that it's not being looked at like the way that Memphis is or New Orleans is because of, it's just cultural amnesia, because the city itself is not lifting it up on its shoulders. But we have a chance to do that now.
Right.
You know?
I interviewed Paul Cawthon a while ago.
Yeah, I know Paul.
And he said that there was, is he from Dallas?
Man, I think he's from East Texas.
Okay.
But I mean, he's real well known around here.
Yeah, and he told me that there was like a this was the spot. Dallas was like where there was like a scene happening. It was like the new hot spot.
I mean, he's right about that, you know. I mean, I've been able to get my thing off the ground thanks to Dallas-Fort Worth. I think Paul would say the same thing, like he's telling you. I mean,
what's the League of Texas Gentlemen or something like that? Are they from here?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they're all Texas cats. All
right.
Leon Bridges, man.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, I mean, that's...
He's a Dallas guy?
Fort Worth.
Okay.
You know, and so that's the thing, man. I got a stronger love out in Fort Worth as I do out here on the Dallas side. And I've been living in Austin the last couple of years. And what I was going to tell you is that I love Austin because it has a New Orleans feel to it. It's got the Tejano music. There's a lot of Cajun influence, a big soul scene.
Yeah.
Blues for days and days. Just like this city. Like I'm saying. So it's like the scene that lifted me up here. Like, there's a scene going on now, and it's like Justin Townes Earl was saying. He was like, you know, people were asking him, like, should a young artist move to Nashville? And he was like, my advice is move anywhere but there, you know? And it's like, I wonder myself, you know, like, I live in Austin a lot now. I mean, my mama lives up here, so I'm forever, you know, got a piece of Dallas, you know? And I came up in these, hitchhiking all over the country, but came up in these bars over the years, you know? Whether people that are on and popping now, like, knew who I was or not. Like, I've been around a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just proud of I'm just proud of what Texas is, what Texas as a in it, like everybody talks about Kentucky and Tennessee and stuff and how it's like got all this stuff going on and it's amazing.
Yeah.
But I think when you look at the sheer amounts of music, the kinds of the styles of music that Texas has to offer, man, it's really diverse. It's the strongest scene in the country.
Hmm.
You know.
When did you start playing? How old were you when you actually started playing? I mean, you said it was in New Orleans, right? So you'd been singing prior to that?
Well, I didn't really start. Well, I consider my 17 is when I really started playing.
It was guitar first?
I got a guitar out the pawn shop that my mama got me. She got me an old Hohner guitar.
Oh, nice.
Out of a pawn shop.
Nice.
And at first, I was just sitting in parks playing.
Because
that was like a little place I could get away and I could from my life and,
yeah.
and do that. And
people, I mean, for people listening, they need to understand that singing and playing an acoustic guitar is like the most vulnerable kind of musical performance you can possibly do. Mm. It's like the next thing would be like to be a stand-up comedian. Mm. I mean, that's not music, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In terms of just like sheer vulnerability. So I'm always fascinated by how people kind of come to that sort of confidence.
Well, actually, it's funny you mentioned the comedian. I think being a comedian is the hardest like art. It's gotta be.
It is so terrible. I love watching comedy, but it scares the shit out of me every time I see somebody do it.
Man, I used to be in, I played all over the streets of New York City, and man, I played every open mic, and a lot of them were music and comedy.
Mm.
And I hung out with a lot of comedians. I lived with a lot of comedians.
Oh, really?
Yeah, man. And
were you living on the street when you were hitchhiking around and busking?
Always,
and
yeah.
Okay.
Always squatting.
Right.
Always staying with people. Always sleeping outside. I did that for a long time.
Okay.
You know, I did it when I was young enough to do it.
Right.
And back when I was in my mid-20s, I thought I could live that way forever.
Right, sure.
But this really isn't much different. You know, I just have a better team, and like sometimes I got a bus, sometimes yeah. I'm in a van.
Was there like a period of transitioning back into like polite society? You know what I
yeah.
mean?
Yeah, I have I got all kind of issues. Like I was just so used to doing everything I was doing was illegal, or like always being in space that was
right.
borrowed.
Right.
I have all these complexes that I can't really get rid of.
Yeah.
You know, where I'm like always feeling like I'm in.
I don't think that shit ever goes away.
It doesn't, man.
I don't think it ever does.
I did that for years, man. I mean, I lived that way for 10 years. You just can't. It's funny you say that. No one's ever asked me like that before, but absolutely, man. Trying to, what did you call it?
Transition back to polite society.
Yeah. This is like stepping out onto the parlor floor.
Right.
You know, and I'm like, yeah. I had to remember that I was taught, you know, some manners when I was a kid by my mama, you know?
It's funny, man.
It messed with my language and my speech and everything.
I go through a version you know? Of the same thing because, you know, where the sort of culture that I grew up around and spent a lot of my early adult life in is different than the sort of the world I find myself, you know,
music
married.
Culture,
and,
man. It's well, a whole, yeah.
But
it's,
now I'm, at all I that. Have this like family life with kids and my kids go to a nice school and we live in a nice place and I'm surrounded by people, a lot of like great, nice people, but it's like, man. Nobody that came from where I came from.
Right.
And I forget that sometimes. Man. Shit comes out of your mouth. And you're like, whoops.
Me too, man. Me too. Man, that's well said, brother.
That's funny. Well, tell me about Europe. You busted around Europe too, right?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Africa? Did I read something about that?
Yeah, so in Africa, I wasn't busking as much. I'll tell you what happened. So, I mean, I was playing on the street in New York for a few years, like 4 years. And I started out at first just playing in parks up there. And people started throwing me change, and I was just there to get my space.
Mm.
They started throwing me change and started moving to better places in the park. Started making more money in the park. Then I started trying playing on street corners down in like the cooler neighborhoods. Like I wanted to play on the street in the East and West Village and up and down Bleecker and stuff.
Mm.
But I found out that they don't really let you do that. They run you off. It's very tough to get people's attention with the traffic from the cars and stuff.
Mm.
Same thing on the train. You want to play at train stops where there's gaps in between the trains. Like during rush hour, it's impossible to perform and get anybody's attention because it's too loud from all the trains flying around. And the street was like that, so it forced me down into the subway.
Mm.
And in the subway, it's actually, you are supposed to have a permit, but if you're not amplified, at least in the era that I was down there, and even now it's like that, and you're not really annoying people, they don't mess with you.
Right,
You see the street performers on the subway
in
New York and stuff all the time.
Yeah.
From the platform, I ended up playing in the train cars with spoken word poets that would come by where I was playing at my little stop. I play at the Metropolitan Avenue stop underneath Williamsburg on the G train below the L train
okay.
in Brooklyn. And yeah, and then I got on the trains that way, and I played that circuit for, I did that for like another 2 years, you know, straight, and I did that solid for, that's where I got most of my practice.
Right, know? Right.
Sorry, I forgot what I was even thinking.
Oh, so how'd you wind up overseas then? Because like, Europe has like a strong appreciation for American roots music that often Americans don't have.
It's true.
So I'm wondering how that.
Well, I went. So when I was doing all that street playing, a guy from a jazz singer from Copenhagen, Denmark, who was coming over there, that was hanging out at a basement club, Lucky Jack's on Orchard Street down there in Lower East Side. He was playing down in this open jazz blues open mic deal. And he got to know me, as he would see me coming through and knew I was a street guy. Over the course of a year, we got tight, and he ended up bringing me over to Copenhagen, and I played like the blues clubs and like coffee house gigs and stuff and around Copenhagen. And I was really rough around the edges, and honestly, not nearly as good as I probably thought I was at the time. Right. But my
confidence counts for a lot, though.
And the genuine nature, I think, like you're talking about, of like American players of a certain kind, I mean, is rough around the edges. I was, man, I was making way more money as a homeless person over there than I was in New York, and I was eating better quality food,
right?
Because the street level food was a lot, you know, I wasn't eating dollar pizza slices over there, and it was, everything was quite a bit healthier.
Yeah,
you know, so that
donor kebabs.
Yeah, a lot of, man. On this last run, we just were over there for a month with JD McPherson, and that's all.
Oh, nice.
That's all I ate was donor kebabs.
All right, so at some point you transition from busking and being more of a street musician to playing in clubs and stuff. How did you wind up getting a record deal and start making records? And it should be noted, you've made a bunch. Your first record was only a few years ago, man. Yeah. You're making the rest of us look lazy. Your fourth one came out today.
I got four out in 3 years.
Yeah. That's an amazing work rate.
Well, that's what they made. I mean, Loretta Lynn had to do it that way.
Sure.
You know, and Hank Williams was doing it that way.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
all
my
blues heroes were doing it that way.
And
I'm independent, so, well, you know, and I'm full of energy. And I, between learning other people's songs and writing my own, man, I mean, you know, if I'm playing the music I want to play, like, I'm never going to get tired of it, and I want to cut 50 of them, you know.
Right. Well, how'd you wind up getting a record deal?
The first record
deal.
How'd
the biz find you?
Okay. I mean, well, I learned a whole mess of stuff by playing for change. And I honestly feel like the only thing that's changed from just busking out of my case to playing here at the Majestic tonight is the politics, you know? And I've got to learn, you know, I had to learn how to play amplified and lead a band. And that just spent the last.
Yeah, just even stuff like having stage monitors. I mean, there's a transition there.
That's what I'm saying, you know, but most everything I needed to know, the street really taught me. But, and true to that, I was discovered by the industry on the train. My band, my group, we were called the Train Robbers, just an underground collective, a loose collective, and we were like getting money. It was working, man. My team was tight, and we were just racking it up in them train cars, flipping every one of them over, and killing it for a couple of years. I mean, people knew us on the street all over New York.
Really?
I can't wait. I hope to get on a late night show in New York one day.
Yeah.
I swear to you, remember me saying this, that a whole bunch of New Yorkers are going to come out and be like, man, we saw this dude in the trains years ago.
Right.
There's a lot
of
footage of me in the trains from back in the day. And the reason I'm saying in New York is because I played it so hard.
Yeah.
I mean, we played it so hard that if you rode the trains and you were a real commuting New Yorker, you saw me in the days of 2000, you know, 10 to 2012. You saw
How many hours are you performing?
I'm talking about 8 to 10 hours every day.
Really?
Yeah, we'd run cycles. So we would
Do you ever lose your voice, or is your voice just so tough from that you're just calloused?
Well, my voice was really, you know, you got an amazing resiliency in your 20s. So I have a strong voice, I think, for where I'm at in my career, but it takes more nursing now than it did when I was in my 20s. And I was doing a lot of things to my voice in my 20s that I'm very lucky I didn't lose it at that time, because I was screaming and hollering over people in the trains. And and when I wasn't screaming and hollering in the trains, I was singing over brass bands unamplified in the quarter. But my grandfather's got a real loud voice like me, and very naturally loud, so I've been able
a resonance to your voice, just it sounds like naturally.
Yeah, so I've been able to keep it. We'll see how long that lasts. So they saw me on the trains, and it was a management deal, but with people really high up in the record industry in Manhattan. I mean, way up there, Sony folks, executive type folks, which those people introduced me to J.D. McPherson. They were courting me to sign this contract in my band, and they took me out to Lincoln Center in Manhattan, and the show, it was a free show out in the park, and it was J.D. McPherson's band with Jimmy Sutton, and they was just popping off. And
like when that North, what's the
North Side Gal?
North Side Gal, yeah.
Yeah, man, and you know that everything that dude does is gold. You know, JD has a lot of songs he hasn't even cut that are hits. It's crazy.
Really?
Oh yeah, man, he's something else. But I signed that deal, and they was looking to, you know, make us into like a mainstream pop act.
Okay, great. Because this I wanted to ask you about this because I listened to all your records, and they all sound like they're recorded like live in a room. I don't know if that's how you actually do it, but that's what it sounds
that's
like.
That's what it is.
Which I figured probably came out of, you know, street performer or whatever. You're probably very comfortable in that way. So I was wondering if you ever experimented with like super modern production and like gridding everything and tuning it. You know what I mean? Like. I didn't know if the way that you recorded was like a reaction, like, that sounds like, that doesn't sound like me kind of thing.
Well, with that group, with that situation, I didn't even let it get that far because of all of the other things in the environment that were happening so quick.
Mm.
It was like this, because what we were doing was working. I mean, you know what I mean? I'm an untrained musician, but like, man, I was playing 8 to 10 hours a day and I was carrying New Orleans songs around with me the trumpet player playing with me and the rappers were the best of the best when it came to the street stuff, man. And like Clarence Greenwood, Citizen Cope, at the time was trying to record us and he was like hanging out with us and we'd go see him and stuff. He was really into the rapper J Don that I was running with for those couple years. And he was like, whatever you do, don't sign that contract with them people. It's gonna break this whole thing up.
Mm.
Don't do it. And I was starving on the street. I was desperate.
It's hard to turn down a recording contract,
especially in
especially
in a desperate position.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
I said, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm signing this. And within 8 weeks, everything he said what happened did, because it just, they didn't have any interest in helping grow the organic thing that was happening there. It was like they saw all this talent that was believable. And want to move it into this other model where it's like you bring an electronic. At that time it was like dub. It was like right when dubstep was like in the top of the mainstream pop you were hearing.
Right.
It's kind of falling off from that peak.
Yeah.
And they were trying to bring us into that and kind of affecting that New Orleans sound, you know. But there was a very Mickey Mouse thing about it. And but mostly beyond that, it's be honest with you, if I wasn't so desperate, if I wasn't so blind from my struggle, I would have known that that's exactly what they were about, but I was pretty much lying to myself because I wanted so badly to get an audience.
Sure.
So I can't just blame it all on these people. A lot of it was me just not being ready, period.
Right.
But you know how it is. It's like that first time when you got to brush with the business real hard, fall down from it, and then reflect, get back up, figure out what you're going to do, and then it tends to work for you. So I sat there.
It either works for you or it's the end of the line.
Or it's the end of the line.
If you keep going, then it's like makes you stronger.
It just about knocked me out, man. You know, and I had already been playing on the streets for years, and I did not want to go back into squatting in these warehouses, man.
Right.
You know, when that deal fell out, but it just wasn't it wasn't what I thought it was going to be, and but I needed that because while I was sitting on the sidelines waiting that contract out, I started getting myself together and I said, you know what, I'm going to record all this stuff myself.
Right.
And I'm going to put it.
When did you start writing in all of this?
I have always been, I was writing songs basically before I was playing. I was just loved music and I was naturally coming up with stuff and not saying, oh, I'm going to write a song. I was just coming up with it.
Phrases and lines and stuff.
Yeah, and it was sticking with me. I just always had that obsession with singing music that I was attracted to, you know. So I start, I don't know, seven, right all at the same time, about 17, 18. I've been writing the whole time, you know, like there's a whole thing being made about my new record being my first one of all originals, which is true, but it don't got nothing to do with having a lack of songs that I'm writing. Man, I'm writing a million songs a minute. It's just
But that's a thing in like a lot of roots music, is playing other people's songs.
And I just like, love that music so much, man. It's just, you know, I got an Elmore James song I do called Cry For Me, Baby. You know, and we just the way we do it, it just cooks like a rockabilly number, and I feel connected to Elmore by playing music that I know he was touring on and stuff, and it's like, you know, it's like Etta James didn't write none of them hits, but you can't tell me those ain't her songs,
right?
You know, Those belong to her. I don't care. Yeah,
absolutely.
Or that version, at least. Yeah. And it sold, too. You know, yeah. Hank Williams did that, too. Lovesick Blues was 50 years old when he cut it.
Oh,
and
really?
Had been cut by many people. And that was his first sustaining radio hit.
Right.
Number
right,
one.
Right.
It stayed up on the charts some crazy amount.
Yeah.
And that became a pipeline for him and Fred Rose and all them writing all them hits.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And the radio cats didn't think that song was going to go anywhere. And even the people around him and his team thought it was too damn podunk and hillbilly to work. And it lit the damn, as Hank would say, you know, it lit the woods on fire.
Yeah. God, I don't know if you watched that movie they made about him. I thought it was terrible.
How do you make a bad
story, man? That's like the greatest story of all time.
Honestly, in a lot of ways, I attribute that to a lot of the, like, you know, hollowness in, you know, fast money, cheap consumer nature of, like, where we're at right now in a lot of our society.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like...
Yeah, man, it's the cleaned up version.
Man, it don't even got nothing to do with Hank.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And they were sitting there saying, oh boy, I'm sorry to knock this dude, but, you know, they were sitting there saying that he was singing them songs well, and he wasn't.
Right.
He was butchering them songs. Right. I know a lot of my friends that could out-sing and probably out-act them in that role.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
So, yeah.
And I'm only passionate about that, man, because it just means so much to me, like it does to you.
I was excited it was coming out. Because I like that actor and others. I thought, oh, great.
Yeah, great actor.
Awesome. Yeah.
Not in that role, though.
Yeah, did not work.
I think they should have given it to Matthew McConaughey, and I think somehow,
right,
even if he can't sing, he'd have pulled it off.
Yeah, you know? Just fake the singing, man. Come on, get a good singer in
we
there.
Can do this. We can do this. It's 2018. Yeah. We can do this.
For real.
Well, let's try again here in a couple of years. You know?
Somebody needs to make that into a Netflix show so it can be longer and way more fucked up. That's my call. Okay, so tell me about our working with our mutual friend, Matt Ross Spang, who produced your new record at the legendary Philips Recording Service.
Oh, man.
Did I get that name right? Philips Recording Service?
Sam Phillips Recording Service.
Sam Phillips Recording. Which, by the way, I never even knew that place existed until I met Matt, who's like has an encyclopedic knowledge of all things Memphis related.
Boy, he does.
Yeah.
And that's why he and I fell in together so well.
Mm.
Because he cut his teeth at Sun. Still there, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they started working at Sun Records when he was 16.
Yeah,
and
he's still a young dude, but goddamn, he's good.
Man, he's good. Yeah,
he
same for me, man. I had hoboed through Memphis. I played at Lafayette's, and I played the High Tone, and used to play at the Buck back when that was a thing. I think it's gone for good this time. I don't really know, but what were we talking about?
Oh, Matt, working with Matt.
Matt, yeah, that's right. Sorry, Boy, I've been running like, man, I can't even tell you all the things I've already done today.
I bet. Well, your record's out today, right?
Yeah.
Lonesome as a Shadow.
Yeah, but Matt, I didn't know it either. We went over there. Man, I just love that dude, man. I like his vibe. He's so Memphis. He knows all the early Sun recordings.
Yeah.
And that's the sound that I want.
Yeah.
And that's the sound we got.
Yeah.
But we mixed in some stacks and some high records, you know, soul in there. And I mean, it was all a dream, man. I've been having like daydreams about being back in that studio and how out of my body I felt, you know, just being in there like with all that energy from all them cats,
and
they cut so easy.
They didn't redo it, like, doesn't
nah.
it? Because he showed me some picture of it. It looks like, I've never actually been there. We're gonna be in Memphis at the end of this.
You need
month,
to get
so
on, get on in
it.
There. You know, I mean, Jared,
it looks like beautiful, like it's like 1962 in there forever or something.
Ain't nothing changed.
Nice.
Nothing's changed, and that's the magic about it. And that Matt's in there, and that the family's still running it. Jerry Phillips, Sam's son is in there.
Oh, really?
That dude is too cool. Yeah, man, he's bad. He's bad as bone. He was hanging out when we was having the session and stuff.
Oh,
and,
nice.
Man, I loved it. I loved it. I just love Memphis, man. It's one of those cities that you can't help but feel the music in you by just being there.
Yeah.
Just love it.
Yeah, it's a great town. And there's always the barbecue.
Yeah.
Doesn't hurt.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, man, and the Vietnamese food ain't too bad neither.
So I imagine you must have like a crazy busy schedule right now. What's next for you? Tour?
Yeah, man.
Album comes out today, boom, you're off and running.
Well, man, I mean, we did 200 shows last year.
Right.
You know, I'm already 57 or something in. I don't know. I guess y'all tour pretty hard too, don't you?
Like, yeah, we've been going since beginning of last summer. It's So we're going to go through the fall.
Yeah, basically. Man. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, yeah, it's nonstop this year. There's hardly any breaks.
Great.
That's how I want it, man.
Yeah.
That's how I want it, man. I want to get back to where I was. Man, I was in this place when I was playing on the streets and stuff, man, because I was able to play. You know, this is amazing what we're doing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of hurrying up and waiting.
Sure.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and everything we got to deal with.
Yeah.
But when I was just in my 20s and I was playing out on the street, man, all I was doing was playing all day. And so in the middle of those times when I was at my peak, man, my performance level was just, I was at this place that's hard to touch, I think, for me.
Right.
And that's why I want to tour so hard, is because I just want to feel that again. And I'm starting to feel that because I'm starting to get to headline.
Right.
You know, I'm starting to really sell tickets. I mean, I think we still need to sell another 30 tickets or so to sell this one out. But
it's amazing.
I'll have sold out all the rooms in this town. You know, the Kessler, Granada, and the Majestic. And that was, you know, I didn't have a plan past the Majestic.
Right.
You know.
So time to get a new plan.
Yeah. Well, I just want to get this band firing off. And if I can do, I want to do classic theaters. You know, I want to do rooms like this as much as I can.
Yeah, it's a beautiful room. Yeah,
this one's owned by the city, you know, and it's real cool to kind of work with a venue in that way.
It's always nice when one of these places doesn't get demolished.
Yeah, man.
You know, there ain't too many.
I don't think we should knock down any more. I think we should bring all the ones back we can.
I agree, man.
We've already rolled over way too much.
Too many.
Yeah.
Dude, well, thanks for taking time out of your day, dude. I really appreciate it, man. It's great to talk with you, brother.
Grateful to play with you, man.
Yeah.
Thank you. Ain't got to worry, child. Nah. All right, that was Charlie Crockett on Walking the Floor. Make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com for all the links to his website, his video, a bunch of the stuff that we talked about in this episode. And I will be back in a couple of weeks with Mr. Tyler Mahan Coe from the Cocaine and Rhinestones podcast. That gives you 2 weeks to listen to all the episodes in season one of his podcast and do your homework so you go into it prepared. All right, make sure you get on over to Spotify, follow the Walk in the Floor playlist, and when you're done with that, listen to all the old interviews still living in the iTunes store. We'll be back in a couple weeks. Adios, amigos!
I wouldn't even try. Call me up, darling. I'll be there in a hurry. Ain't got to worry, child. Not for long. Call me up, darling.